around this issue. And as soon as the fires happened, that coalition shattered. And people said, I don't want anything to do with this group anymore. These people are crazy. And they lost all of their leverage and all of their political power. And they said the conversation turned from being about this terrible thing that they thought the resort was doing to being about arson. And Daniel said the same thing. I mean, after the Jefferson Poplar fires, all the media was talking about was catching these people and what are we going to do to catch these people? And nobody was talking.
Eco-terrorism.
And eco-terrorism. And nobody was talking about the things that they were trying to draw attention to. So it's a sticky question.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, I just can't believe how time has flown. I there's so much, so many other things I wanted to ask you about, including, you know, what's happening with people today. So we're going to have you back.
People can also take a look. We've got a Facebook page where people post questions and have conversations and a website, ifatreefallsfilm.com.
Marshall Curry, filmmaker of If a Tree Falls. And that's it. We are out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our engineer, Teddy Robinson. You could email me directly at mpkpfk@gmail.com.
And that's it for Sojourner Truth Radio. You're listening to KBOO, KBOO, Portland at 90.7 FM. Also streaming on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Bike Show, immediately following this test of the emergency alert system.
This is a coordinated monthly test of the emergency alert system through broadcast stations in the greater Portland-Vancouver area, including Clackamas, Columbia, Multnomah, and Washington counties in Oregon, and Clark County in Washington. With the cooperation of public safety broadcasters and cable operators, this system informs you of events that pose an immediate threat to your life, health, or property. If this had been an actual emergency, official information would have followed the alert tone. This test was originated by Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency in Vancouver, Washington. This concludes this test message.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the Bike Show. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from City Bikes. It's a worker-owned, cooperatively run, new and used bicycle sales and service shop with two locations on Southeast Ankeny near KBOO. They open 7 days a week for your bicycle commuting needs and online at citybikes.coop.
Good morning. You're tuned in to The Bike Show, broadcasting live from the KBOO studios here in glorious Portland, Oregon. I'm Tori Bortman, here joined today by my co-host, Terry Campbell. Good morning, Terry.
Hi, good morning, Tori. How you doing?
I am lovely. Excited that summer is here. Yeah. And today we're getting amped for all sorts of summer adventures. In the first half of our show, we're joined by the world-renowned racer, author, and cycling advocate, Rebecca Rush. Rebecca is joining us today to talk about her new film, Blood Road. In the second part of our show, we'll be discussing the growing sport of bikepacking with Nicholas Carman, expert bikepacker and self-proclaimed gypsy by trade, as well as Harry Delgarde of Travel Oregon to talk about the new Oregon Timber Trail, and one of the first riders of that trail, Kim McCormick. Rebecca Rush is known in cycling circles as the Queen of Pain, a hard-earned moniker reflecting her career as a seven-time world cycling champion, crushing endurance racer, her first ascent of El Capitan for a woman, as well as producer of her own notorious endurance race, Rebecca's Private Idaho. But Rebecca isn't all pain. She's also an accomplished author, cycling coach, motivational speaker, and cycling advocate. This range of pain, power, and intimate connection brought her to her latest project, The Blood Road, a feature-length documentary produced by Red Bull Media House. Blood Road follows Rebecca and her Vietnamese riding partner, Huyen Nguyen's 1,200-mile journey along the Ho Chi Minh Trail to find the place where her father, a U.S. Air Force pilot, was shot down during the Vietnam War. Good morning, Rebecca Rush. Welcome to the KBOO Bike Show.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start off by asking you, this is such an amazing, amazing project that you worked on and created. Where did the seed for this film come from?
Yeah, it's actually been a long time coming. I really feel like this ride has been an evolution of my career, and I've been kind of thinking about it since 2003, when I first went to Vietnam during an adventure race before I was bike racing and spending time in the jungle. And it was really, that's when I really started to think about my dad spending time there and the soldiers, and just, I think physically being in that place really kind of sparked a curiosity for me.
Did you run into remnants of the war?
We went and visited some of the war sites. Like, we went to Da Nang Air Force Base where my dad was stationed. I went to a battlefield called Khe San. That's now a beautiful coffee plantation. And our Vietnamese guide pointed out and said, look over there, that's the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And that was the first time to see, you know, I knew my dad was shot down over the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but I hadn't physically, you know, been there. And so it was a long time ago, but it sparked an interest really that was just, I want to go back there sometime. And it took, you know, his remains were found in 2007, and that kind of piqued my curiosity again, knowing that, okay, he did die that day in the crash, and I wonder what's at those crash coordinates. And, you know, I've always loved map and compass, and so it kind of took an evolution, and then it really wasn't until 2013 that I started pitching the idea to Red Bull and talking to them about, hey, I want to go try to ride the entire length of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. I want to go look for this spot. And it was a culmination of a personal journey, but really my experience as an athlete and an expedition athlete and a cyclist, that I wanted to go explore and see the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And I also wanted to see what was at the crash site. And so it took a long time for the idea to marinate and come together.
And you had a riding partner. Please help me pronounce her name correctly.
Huyen.
Huyen. Yeah, yes.
Yeah. She was amazing to ride with. She was a total stranger when I started. You know, creatively, Red Bull Media House and I, we talked about how amazing it would be to ride with somebody from that culture and kind of see the trail and the terrain through their eyes. And so we did a little research, and Huyen, she fit the bill really physically as you know, being a previous mountain bike racer, one of the most decorated cyclists in Vietnam. And I like the fact that she was female, and she had the desire to go, really. I mean, it's a big ask to ask somebody to spend a month of your life, go ride with a total stranger in the middle of the jungle.
Absolutely. And, I was just thinking that. I was like, was she down for that right off? Did she take any convincing? But no, it sounds like she was like, had she ever done anything like that before?
No. And she was physically really outside of her element. You know, she had been a mountain bike racer in Vietnam, but had been retired for a number of years, a single parent, a mom with two kids. And she was racing cross country races. So she was racing hour and a half, even when she was at her peak. And so a multi-day, you know, month long expedition, camping out, there were a lot of firsts for her, like using a camelback for the first time, putting up a tent for the first time. So,
Mention leaving your kids for a month. That's huge.
Yeah. She really did dedicate herself to, you know, one, an adventure that was really intriguing and interesting for her and a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. But, yeah, she had to put her life on hold and trust me enough to go with me.
That
was probably one of the riding with a stranger for both of us. I think that was one of my biggest fears going into this expedition was not knowing my teammate. You know, I've never done something this big with a total stranger. But really, she ended up being such an amazing part of the story and really allowing me to grow emotionally and allowing me to see the trail through different eyes than if I'd gone just with my own racer mentality and, you know, with blinders on a little bit. So she did end up being a really wonderful gift to the whole trip and the film especially.
Hey, Rebecca, this is Terry. How did you connect? How did you connect with her, and does she live near where you were riding, and were some of the trails you guys were riding on part of her backyard, so to speak?
No, she lives in Ho Chi Minh City, you know, gigantic city. Her family lives in Hanoi, and so this was the first time on a lot of this terrain for her as well, and that was part of when I asked her, you know, why did you want to go, you know, for the Vietnamese culture, and I mean, the Ho Chi Minh Trails representative of their independence and their freedom. And so it was a dream for her to be able to go explore. So a lot of the territory was unknown to her, but the culture was similar. And we started, you know, in her father's hometown and then finished in her hometown. So she was most comfortable in the city riding. That's probably when people ask me, you know, if I was scared on the trail. Not at all in the jungle, really only when we were in Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City and there are all the scooters and cars and people, but she was totally at home in that terrain.
So you just stayed on that wheel?
Yeah, I just followed her when we got in the cities. I'm like, all right, I'll take charge in the jungle. You can be the leader in the cities.
Well, you mentioned Huyen took about her taking some time off. What was it like for you to take time off of racing and some of the other things you do, your other work that you do as an advocate and speaker? I mean, that's kind of your life. How is this shift for you to go out there and do this project?
It was definitely risky as a professional athlete. You know, a lot of my contracts and my relationships are based on racing and earning podiums. But really, I mean, this was a once in a lifetime opportunity with Red Bull Media House. And it was one of those things I had to do no matter what, and I had to make it work. And the partners, you know, I had long conversations with a lot of my partners. This is what I'm going to be doing for the next 2 to 3 years of my life, really. The project started 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the partners that are good partners, they totally understood. They're like, oh my gosh, amazing opportunity. Yes, we're right there with you. And so it was definitely a shift for me. And, you know, when people are like, oh, what race are you doing? Or what do you sign up for next? I really did have to commit 100% to this project because physically, emotionally, with my family, with my other work, it took everything. You know, I had to commit 100%.
Mm-hmm.
But it was such an evolution now coming back and being able to share the film and everything I learned. I know that it's my career is going to blossom from it, and all the opportunities, you know, I don't even know what opportunities are going to come up. And so it was a giant risk, but it's just like everything we've done in our careers that are worthwhile, like living out of my car and, you know, going and racing around the world. Like every risk I've taken where I said, okay, I'm going to just go for it, I haven't regretted it. And this was another one of those things. It's like, I know this is going to be worth it no matter what. And I was willing to take the risk personally, you know, to be able to do the journey, I had to go no matter what happened in the end, whether I lost, you know, all my jobs when I came home. And my husband went with me, which was really important. He was on the crew.
Oh,
and so we got
excellent.
To experience that together, and I didn't have
What work did he do for the crew, or was he just general wrangler?
He was he was a backup cyclist in case, you know, if we needed a backup cyclist. So he was kind of there as backup, but he was also you know, helped. I had a mechanic there with me who was basically getting food ready, making sure equipment's ready. You know, he and Jason, we had a two-person crew for support, but they were really essential and they did everything.
You only had two people other than the film crew?
No, the film crew was six people, so the
right.
whole thing was pretty small.
That's,
the riding crew
that's
was
tiny.
Two people. Yeah, it was very tiny. It had to be like a really, you know, we had to be really nimble, and there's no way to have a big film production over there. I mean, a lot of the trail is not accessible even by motorcycle. And, you know, you're hacking through the jungle and crossing multiple borders, and so there wouldn't have been any way to do it without a small, nimble crew. And all the film crew are on motorcycles. Some of them are ex-BMX racers, ex-game athletes, and I mean, I think really they had a harder time filming than we did riding because they were carrying so much equipment.
Yes, as I recently had an opportunity this summer to do some trail building, and I was like, wow, hiking with chainsaws, it's a whole new different thing than actually riding your bike on the trail later. So you're obviously one of the toughest women out there as an adventure cyclist, and to even attempt a ride like this, you've got to be incredibly strong. But at the same time, being filmed and having a crew with you like that has got to be also extremely intimate, as well as the fact that you're on this really vulnerable personal journey. How did you balance these parts of yourself of being so vulnerable, even in the woods and the jungle where you felt comfortable? That was, you were very vulnerable to a camera.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, physically, the journey is the biggest ride I've ever done. And logistically, you know, the planning and the mapping was one of the hardest, it was the hardest expedition I've ever planned, but the physical part of the journey definitely wasn't the hardest part for me. You definitely hit the nail on the head that, you know, the hardest part for me was being vulnerable and being open and traveling with strangers and allowing them into my life. And as an athlete, you know, a longtime professional athlete, I've built up a pretty strong exterior. You know, I'm strong, I'm invincible, I'm the queen of pain, you know?
Right.
And it takes a lot to strip away those defense layers. I've built those up over the years, and I've worked really hard at that.
Well, it's part of your racing game. It's part
it
of
is,
winning.
And, yeah. Well, and yeah, and we all have that weak side, but you know, we don't often show it. And especially, you know, I grew up pretty independent family, a single mom, and I had to take care of myself when mom was at work. And so, the hardest part of this trip for me really was letting people in. And I think that's one of the gifts that Huyen brought, is she's probably more emotionally mature and understanding than I am, whereas I was teaching her a lot physically about, you know, being tough and keeping going and day after day. And I think she was really helping me open up emotionally. And I think the film crew too, because they were on motorcycles and we were on this gnarly expedition together, you know, we were all in it together, and I really did forget. Eventually, I forgot that the cameras were there, and especially in the really important moments in the film, I don't remember the camera crew being there, and that speaks a lot for how the kind of care that they took with this journey for me. You know, they weren't asking me to do things over and over again, and we didn't have the time to on the trail a lot. And some of the most important moments of the film are a one-shot deal. You know,
right? It's what you see is what you get.
Yeah, and so they did a lot of preparation ahead of time to make sure that I could experience this in real time. And while we did have to wait, you know, for the film crew, and there was definitely some logistics of charging batteries and equipment, really I was experiencing it as I would organically. And that was really special, and that allowed me to just be in the moment. And I know that people will ask, why did you have to ride all 1,200 miles to go to this crash site? Why didn't you just go there? And for me, I needed 1,200 miles, days on the trail, to strip away those defense layers and allow myself to be open to the experience. If I just went to the crash site, you know, just in one day, it wouldn't have been the same thing. I needed to combine, you know, my ultra endurance knowledge, my meditation. I mean, I know you've got bike packing coming up on the show next, and that's what I do to allow myself to be going long distance, allow myself to really be open. And that was the only way to let the film show in that way, is if I did some really long days of riding and, you know, was uncomfortable and,
yeah, it's interesting,
the defense layers.
A few minutes ago, you kind of equated, I think you said, I'm not used to being weak in that way, when you were referring to being more emotional and open. And in some ways, because it is so hard, it's almost like you have to be stronger to be that vulnerable, I think.
And that's been interesting. Yeah, I look at, you know, vulnerable as weak, but after this trip, you know, people have commended me and said, thank you for being so strong to show your emotion and show yourself. And that was a big twist for me to actually realize, yeah, so it's totally okay to do this, and maybe it is actually stronger to be open. And I think that's one of the things that Huyen brought to the table that, you know, I wasn't as adept at, is like showing your emotion. And I think she and I had a language barrier. You know, I don't speak Vietnamese and she spoke English okay. But the fact that we actually had to communicate nonverbally and just with a hug or a look was actually really interesting for me. And I think the communication was actually more unique than had we been able to say everything we wanted to say.
Well, I was just curious to know what kind of bikes you guys were riding on and what was the terrain like out there? You guys went 1,200 miles. what, I mean, I'm sure it was varied, but maybe give the listeners a little bit of an idea of the sort of daily struggles, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, when I was planning, the unknown of the trail was one of the things that looking at my bike and the equipment and what I'm going to bring, and that was actually really kind of a roll of the dice, knowing there'd be a lot of intense jungle terrain, but there's also a road section. So, you know, the closer we were to the start and the finish near the cities, there were, you know, traffic and crazy scooters everywhere and the kind of chaos that you imagine in Southeast Asia with pavement. But then pretty quickly you got out to dirt roads, and then especially in Laos and Cambodia was very deep jungle and places where, you know, they've never seen a tourist, they've never seen a carbon fiber bicycle, and there were lots of places where, you know, bridges are washed out and you have to go around, or you have to hire a boat to get across a river or go through a cave. And it's one section
or
of the
go through a cave.
Yeah, we went through a cave. We had to use machetes at one point in the trail. I had a machete in my Camelback. So it really was totally buried terrain, and also some really fun riding, because between these villages, you know, there's just footpaths, or they're using a scooter or they're walking. And so it makes for some really great mountain biking. And so I rode, we were both on Niners, and Huyen had chosen a hardtail 29er. The Air 9 RDO, and I chose the Jet 9, which is a full suspension bike, just knowing over the long distance that I wanted to have suspension, and also wanted, you know, for the technical sections, I wanted the comfort. And she chose the hardtail just because that's what she was familiar with from her bike racing, but she'd never used disc brakes, she'd never used 29-inch wheels, so this was a whole new world for her. And I was really happy with my setup. You know, we had on the trail one flat tire the whole entire
Whoa.
Time, 1,200 miles. No mechanicals, no issues, which was great. You know, plenty of crashes and, you know, putting the bikes in boats and on, you know, through the cave and hike a bike. But they survived really well. They did really great.
Did you get lost ever?
Yeah. Yeah, we got lost. you know, that's just, but again, that's something, I love navigation. And, you know, we had mapped the route with a guy named Don Duval, who's a motorcycle guide over there. And he spent 10 years of his life mapping the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Like, they hadn't had GPS maps for that area.
Wow.
And we found him, and he was really essential, and because he knew all this history of the trail. He had mapped it on his motorcycle. And so he really helped us piece together a historically accurate route. And so we had GPS loaded every day. We had maps, but like I said, you know, you'd come across, oh, there's supposed to be a trail here. And then, you know, because of the rainy season, it's washed out or something's different.
Or because it's a jungle, it grew over.
Yeah, exactly. There were sections that were grown over. And so, you know, I wouldn't say that, you know, we are lost and that we couldn't find our way back, but there were definitely plenty of wrong turns and backtracking and like, oh wait, okay, there's no trail here, there's supposed to be a trail. But that's the fun adventure part of it.
Yeah, the footage,
I didn't ever feel like we were gonna like stay overnight in the jungle and not pop out and find, you know, find our crew.
Yeah, the footage from the trailer makes, I mean, obviously if you the landscape is so dramatic, it's so straight up and straight down and jungly. And does the Ho Chi Minh Trail follow any sort of you know, ridge lines, like, or do they follow rivers, or is it kind of a little bit of everything, sort of just blasting up over topographical lines and making your life really hard? And is it just a little bit of everything?
It's definitely a mixture of everything. I mean, it generally follows the border of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, because, you know, the history of the trail is, you know, the North Vietnamese put the trail over into Laos and Cambodia to try to hide it from the Americans. And so it pretty generally follows the north-south line that's the border of Vietnam. And so there's a big mountain range between Laos and Vietnam. And so it is very hilly. As you get down towards the south in Cambodia, it gets really hot and really sandy and a little bit flatter. And you're kind of in the Mekong Delta region. And towards the north, it's a bit more mountainous. You know, some big passes that we had to go over to enter from Vietnam into Laos. Was a giant pass that we did on the first day. So it really was a bit of everything and crossing a lot of rivers. I don't know how many river crossings there were every day. Countless. I couldn't even begin to count them.
So Rebecca,
it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever ridden a bicycle. It's awesome there.
Rebecca Resch, did you end up finding what you were looking for?
I did. You know, we did find the location of the crash site, but that ended up being, you know, I found so much more than that. I couldn't even predicted what this trip was going to be. And, you know, a lot of people have said, oh, it must have been closure to find your dad's crash site. And it's exactly the opposite of me. For me, it really was a discovery of me, of my family history, you know, even my living family, getting to know my mom and my sister better through this journey. But bigger than that, bigger than just me and our family story, it was finding a new culture and a new way of, a slower way of life and looking at the world, you know, a little bit less with blinders on from a racer mentality and kind of looking left and right a little bit more and seeing the world in a different way. And really the most unexpected thing that I found from this trip was a new purpose for my riding. And I came away, you know, one of the biggest discoveries that was sad and shocking to me, but also exciting because I can do something about it, is all of the unexploded ordnance that are still left there. Mm-hmm. There are tons of bombs that we dropped that didn't detonate that still threaten lives every day with the villagers, and I had no idea. And I feel like my dad brought me there to that site to teach me that, you know, even though he's gone, he's teaching me. And so I came home with a new mission to clean up Laos in his name and kind of close the circle of healing and recovery. And so this film tour and a lot of the work that I'm doing now is fundraising for the Minds Advisory Group, directed the funds to Laos in my dad's name to clean up the bombs and let the villagers over there get on with their lives and recover. So that was a really something great that I found, you know, a new purpose for my riding and a way to use my bike to do good things.
Well, and it's crazy to think that those unexploded bombs have been in the ground as long as you've been alive.
They have, and it's kind of shocking, you know, and the estimate is that, you know, 58,000 Americans died in the Vietnam War, and the estimate is that, you know, nearly that number have died or been injured since the war just from the unexploded ordnance. So it's time to clean it up and recover and heal from that experience.
It looks like you connected in the trailer pretty well with some of the local folks. How was your connection to people on the trail?
They were so amazing. They're so friendly there. And, you know, we went in with a little bit of trepidation and, you know, very humbly, you know, an American person coming and looking for her father. And we were welcome with open arms, you know, villagers wanting to help us. And the bike is such a great, universally accepted mode of travel that I think when people see you on a bicycle, they kind of understand you're on a journey. And we were helped along the way, given food, you know, brought into people's homes, given, you know, disgusting Lao Khao whiskey to share with them.
Can we do a whole show on that? I need to learn more about Lao Khao whiskey. Awesome.
It doesn't taste good. But well, the deal is you have to drink it to protect, so the spirits protect you on your journey. So you're like, all right, I need the spirits working with me here.
Cool. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. If our listeners wanted to learn more over social media or purchase your book or learn about where they could see the film Blood Road, where would they connect with you?
Yeah, so bloodroadfilm.com, the film's available now, and all the screening dates or downloads are there, and also my fundraising activities for the Minds Advisory Group are there. And then my social media and website is Rebecca Rush, R-U-S-C-H, so it's easy to find me there.
I have to tell you, as I was preparing for the show, I was also actually in the woods with very little cell reception, and I went to a small mountain town. I was mountain biking, went to a small mountain town to use the internet in a cafe, and on the window of the cafe, there was a flyer advertising your movie being shown in Hood River, Oregon. So that was very exciting to see. I was like, oh, it's karma. It's all coming around.
Yeah, that's great.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thanks for talking to me about it, you guys. And hopefully you get to see the film or come join me at a screening soon.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm fired up.
Right on. Thanks for having me on the show. And yeah, I'm curious to hear about the bike packing that you're going to talk about next, because that's definitely been a trajectory of my career, is going along unsupported. It's definitely a fun way to explore and see the world.
Totally.
And it sounds like you might have to get in touch with our next guest, too.
Absolutely.
I think so. Absolutely.
Stay tuned in. Thanks, Rebecca. You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show on KBOO 90.7. Stay with us for the second half of the show, where we will continue our day of adventure exploring and bike packing with folks from the Oregon Timber Trail. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the KBOO Bike Show here on 90.7 FM. Bike packing is the hottest trend in adventure and cycling. Bike packing is essentially bike touring, but completely off-road. Some routes are single track, some are gravel, and one that our next guest helped create involves quite a bit of sand and beachfront. Nicholas Carman, in his own words, rides bikes to get places. Sometimes those places are far away. Often I enjoy taking my time. He is also the partner to the first female transcontinental winner. Again, in his words, and that's Lael. She's almost always in front of me or behind me or beside me. We spend half the year working and saving money and half the year riding bikes. In fact, we ride bikes all year. We left on our first bike tour in September 2008 on two secondhand bikes, each purchased for $300. We spend half the year working and saving money and half the year riding bikes. We ride all year. a self-proclaimed gypsy by trade. When he's not working, riding, and saving, he and Lael have been creating their own new bikepacking routes. We are thrilled today to have him join us on the show. Nicholas Carman, welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So can you start by telling us how you got into bikepacking?
Bikepacking kind of grew naturally out of just traveling my bike around the city. So I grew up in New York State and mountain biked a little bit at the time, and would either get dropped off somewhere or drive somewhere once I was old enough. But I moved to Tacoma, Washington in 2003 to go to college, and actually mostly quit riding because the city didn't require that I rode. So I rode a skateboard for a bunch of years until eventually I dropped out of school and I got a job that was 4 miles away. So I had to get to school, or rather I had to get to work, and to get that distance I needed a bike. So I got back into riding bikes, and in the course of the next couple of years, I started commuting all around Tacoma. And then the big thing was one day, my girlfriend and I, Lael, needed to get to Seattle, and we didn't have money for bus fare, and the fare was only $3. But nonetheless, we didn't have any cash, so we charted a route to Seattle, and we rode to Seattle in a day. And at that time, we realized that we could go further by doing the same kind of thing, just ride 40 miles in a day.
That seems like it quickly spiraled into creating your own routes.
Oh, that didn't happen anytime soon. That was a 2-3 year process already to transition from being a confident commuter to deciding that I wanted to go on a tour.
That's pretty quick for a lot of people.
Well, you know, the first tour was just meant to be a tour down the East Coast, and it was. But we landed in Key West, Florida, and we got jobs as pedicab drivers. Lael worked in a restaurant, and within 2 or 3 months, we saved a little pile of cash, and we rode out of town. And that's where things really started to grow, because rather than just going on a single bike tour that we would put behind us, we continued a pattern, which has continued now for about 9 years.
And you've been basically following the sun or the weather. How do you make that work?
We follow our interests. I think any given day, any week, any month, we go where we want to go. So we settle in sometimes and work for a couple months and commit to things. And occasionally we commit to trying to ride most of a route or trying to ride from one place to another. But a lot of the time we don't have an end destination in mind when we're touring. Nor do we have an end date. So that's kind of the pattern of touring for us, is that to keep things relevant so that we always want to be doing what we're doing. We're not committed to anything that, you know, we decided 6 months ago.
So what are your, if you're to choose, do you have a favorite type of route?
Favorite type of route? Yeah, you know, my favorite type of route in general are the routes we've ridden in Europe, because you'll be doing something that at one moment is casual, passing maybe through just some farmland, or ambling through small forests on a footpath, and then all of a sudden there's a steep pitch and a footpath goes up a mountain and you're hiking your bike. But then again, off the backside, you have a fun descent, and then you're back through some farmland into the middle of town. So the diversity of those kind of routes is what inspires me most. Although I do truly love some of the mountain bike routes we have in the United States, like the Colorado Trail, the Arizona Trail. So that stuff in itself is some of the best riding I've done. But for me, staying interested is more than just riding.
And yet, you created a route in Mexico. So
yeah, we did.
Why the Baja Divide?
Well, the reason is because we've ridden a lot of other routes that other people have provided, and I'm always looking for ways to get more people on bikes. And over the years, I've done a lot of blog writing and some publishing in other magazines and websites, and it's great to reach people. But I wasn't sure that words and images were enough to really get people on bikes. And after truly using other people's resources all around the world, I think I just realized that if I provided something similar, it would actually get people on bikes and allow them to have meaningful experiences through which they become now advocates for the kind of thing that we love most. So rather than just trying to write on the internet or in magazines and convince people that they should do this kind of thing, put more people on bikes. So in this case, we put probably 200 to 250 people on the Baja Divide route in the first season, and now they're all advocates for the thing that we love.
And how did you go about creating that route? And did you get a chance to pre-write it before you created it?
Well, that's the only way it was made, was that we wrote it. So the long story is that we traveled to Baja, California in 2010 or 2011. We crossed the border. We actually rode from Tacoma, Washington, leaving November 16th, and had the most miserable wet ride down the coast that you could imagine. And we crossed into Baja, California on New Year's Day, and then for the next 3 months in Mexico, we didn't see a drop of rain. So partly for that reason, we fell in love with the place, but it was our first real kind of exotic international tour. And so we mostly traveled at that time on the roads, and this is at a time when we're transitioning to riding more dirt roads and trails and we were on more conventional touring bikes, but we did get off onto some of the rougher sections of road. When looking for a place to travel in 2015, after Lael had raced the Tour Divide twice and attempted to race the Arizona Trail, we were looking for something that for us would be relatively easy and relaxed. And so we thought about traveling in other parts of the world, but Baja California just seemed easy for us because you can just step out your front door from Southern California and be in another country. And so we started traveling there. And after about 2 weeks of touring, just for our own purposes, we realized that we were finding some incredible riding and that being this close to the United States, we really needed to share this with people. And considering that there's nowhere else to ride that time of year in the States, everything's too cold and frozen in January and February, it just seemed like a perfect thing to share with people.
Yeah, it seems like there's a definite draw to sun. Is there a lot of elevation gain or loss on the Baja Divide?
It's deceiving. It's not a lot of big passes, but there's a lot of climbing and a lot of steep climbing. And a lot of it's technical, too, in that it's loose or sandy or just eroded and rough. So it adds up. I wouldn't say that it looks like a lot of climbing, but it feels like it to some people.
You are tuned into the KBOO Bike Show. I'd like to bring a few more guests into the conversation to talk about Oregon's newest adventure route, the Oregon Timber Trail. The 650-mile trail crosses the length of our state from California to the Columbia River with over 65,000 feet of elevation gain and on some of the most remote and beautiful trails Oregon has to offer. Harry Dalgard is a destination development specialist on the destination development team at Travel Oregon. The team is focused on working with Oregon communities and Oregon businesses to help them realize their tourism potential and better participate into Oregon's booming tourism economy. As part of that work, Travel Oregon has formed a partnership with the Oregon Timber Trail to promote the route that follows the length of the state. And I'd also like to welcome Kim McCormick. She's an avid mountain biker and adventurer, and last year she rode the length of the Oregon Timber Trail with a buddy and support from some friends. She's here to give us an in-person perspective for what the trail holds for those of you who'd like to check it out. Harry Dalgard and Kim McCormick, welcome to the KBOO Bike Show.
Awesome, thanks.
So, for listeners who don't know what the Oregon Timber Trail is, Harry, can you describe it better than I did?
Yeah, absolutely. You touched on it really well, though. It's a 670-mile collection of trails that are all permissible to mountain biking. They already exist on the ground. And basically what it is, it's a collection of these trails to weave in and out of five different national forests and four different Oregon Timber Trail tiers. So it starts down in Lakeview, Oregon, and traverses through the Fremont-Wainema Forest, and then heads its way north through the Willamette National Forest, in addition to the Deschutes, finally finishing in the Mount Hood National Forest. And it's just a really cool experience for backcountry mountain bikers to get out there and experience all the diversity that the Oregon landscape has to offer, and at the same time have a crazy, huge adventure.
So, are you promoting it as an adventure route or as a bikepacking route? Or are you promoting it more as go ride this?
To be determined. I mean, it's just it's infancy, right? So we've been working the past 2 years on developing the route and the collection of trails with the Forest Service, in addition to a collection of advocates on the ground across the state. Throughout that 2 year period of time, we've formed a nonprofit, the Oregon Timber Trail Alliance, which will formally kind of take on the development efforts of it. But outside of that, Travel Oregon's interested in it because it is such an iconic experience, and we want to have this experience that's similar to the Pacific Crest Trail for mountain bikes, and be able to really showcase that as inspiration to visit the state of Oregon, as well as an opportunity for people to ride the whole length, or maybe even just a segment here or there.
Right, because it's divided into four segments, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, and Kim McCormick, you have literally wheels-on experience of the trail. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like for you to go out there and ride it?
Absolutely. I have nothing but great things to say about the Oregon Timber Trail. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good. This is my first time on the radio. So, the Oregon Timber Trail for me was life-changing and probably one of the best decisions that I made. And when I signed up to do it. I thought, I didn't know what to expect. I knew I loved riding my mountain bike. I knew I rode my bike a lot. I knew I loved being out in the mountains and discovering new places. And I had never ridden multiple days in a row, upwards of 12 hours per day. And when we went into this, we hadn't even expected to ride that amount of hours per day. And when people do it, they don't have to ride that many hours a day. You do what you want. You do what feels right for you. And when we got out there and started going, it was just perfect. It was the right place. It, when we would start pedaling and we got 2 hours in, 4 hours in, 6 hours in, we thought, well, what else are we going to do with the day? Let's keep pedaling. Well, let's see what's around the corner.
And that being said, you were not bike packing it.
Correct.
So you had a support crew.
We did have a support crew. The Oregon Timber Trail, we found out about it because originally, I was in Colorado, actually, visiting some friends and came across the Colorado Trail. I knew nothing about it. And I said to my husband, Ben, hey, did you know this trail goes all the way from Denver to Durango? And he looked at me, he said, absolutely not. You find somebody else to do that with you. And so I messaged a friend of mine, Sam, who's my buddy, and she's like, absolutely, yeah, let's do an adventure ride. So she, as we were starting the planning phase of this, and we got our maps and we got going, she said, hey, I have this great friend who they're in the developmental phase of the Oregon Timber Trail, and they think that this would be a great thing for us to do. What do you think? And I said, yeah, sign me up. It's in our backyard. It goes through the beautiful parts of Oregon I've never been to before. So we decided to jump on board, and it was in the developmental phases. So our mission was, one, ride the route, confirm the trail route that it's there, and report back on what areas needed some work. And this year we've gotten a lot of work done.
So you were a scout.
I was scouting it out with my friend Sam.
Full on guinea pig.
So that meant a lot of climbing over trees.
There was some climbing over trees. And what?
Some?
There was a lot.
Okay.
And so Samurai, I call her Samurai. We came up, I was Kimchi, she's Samurai. And we called it the Blowdown Blues. And we just sang. We sang songs and we just passed bikes to each other. And it was part of the adventure. And I think that brought on a lot of self-discovery within myself. What I learned was I can make agreements with myself and I get to choose where I'm going in life. And right now I'm going over this tree, and right now I'm with my buddy in the forest in this beautiful place in this great landscape, from lavas to blowdown to mossy to big expansive views. And we saw, my husband Ben saw a bear, and you know, we saw elk and deer.
Only one bear the whole time?
Only one bear.
Wow,
yeah.
That's great. What time of year were you there?
We were there end of July.
Oh, okay.
Beginning of
that's
August.
Amazing. You guys must have been singing a lot.
Yeah, we were singing a lot.
That keeps the bears away.
Yeah, it
does. That's how the Alaskans do it, is that, am I right, Nicholas? Mm-hmm.
That's right. I saw a bear yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah. Singing does a lot for that. So Harry, Kim just mentioned that the trail, when she did it, needed a lot of work. Can you talk about the progress of the trail, how it's going right now?
Yeah, so, I mean, the trail exists, and it has existed in its current form for a long period of time. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of the Oregon Timber Trail. It's a primarily single-track experience. Over 50% of it is single-track. And these trails have existed for a long period of time, but with that being said, there's a lot of areas that don't always get the same amount of use like the Mount Hood National Forest does. So a lot of those areas are in need of clearing. And to that extent, the Oregon Timber Trail Alliance has gotten 20 Sawyers certified with the Forest Service.
Can you explain what a Sawyer is?
Yeah, Sawyer is somebody that goes in and does trail maintenance in cooperation with the Forest Service. So they're really trail stewards. So the work that the Timber Trail Alliance has done, both on the Fremont-Wainema National Forest in addition to the Willamette National Forest, has really helped improve the trail conditions by clearing out all that blowdown that Kim had just talked about. So we've done two volunteer weekends down there to really help the conditions, so that the experience for not just mountain bikers but for equestrians and hikers is much better in that area as well. So
And what are you doing right now to promote the trail? Or is it even open? Is it? Is there a map?
So the route guide is going to be released in the next few weeks.
Woo!
We're encouraging riders that want to go in this pioneering year to take about 2 to 3 weeks.
That being said, I'm going to interrupt you for a second.
Yeah, no problem.
Kim, you did the route in 2 to 3 weeks, not loaded, correct?
Correct.
And how would you say, and you were saying 12-hour days.
Yeah, you know, at some points we were going 1 mile an hour with the blowdown.
Right.
And with the work that's been put into the Oregon Timber Trail, I think the experience is going to be different.
And do you still think it'll be 2 to 3 weeks for people?
You know, I think every person who gets out there gets what they want and need out of the Oregon Timber Trail. And I think there's many rights to how to approach it. You can do segments, you can do the full thing, you can be loaded, you can be supported. And it's kind of like those books, Choose Your Own Adventure, I think about, you know, like what is it that you're looking for from the Oregon Timber Trail? And whatever you're looking for from it is what you'll get because it has so much to offer. It is an amazing route with unbelievable single track landscape and a combo of gravel road sections. So I think people who are loaded, those gravel road sections are nice and clear, and you pick up a lot of space there. So
Harry, you, when the route was being designed, you were picking mostly linking existing trails, correct? There's no new...
No, there's no new trail construction. There's no... there's nothing really that signifies the Oregon Timber Trail on the ground either. So that's an important consideration. This is a collection of pre-existing trails on the ground already. So once the route guide is developed, that will kind of be your Bible in terms of how to navigate and link all these pre-existing trails, because you're not going to see a sign or any type of really...
At least yet.
Maybe long-term down the road, you'll see that and maybe some... awesome future improvements.
Well, we never thought we'd see Oregon Scenic Bikeways either, exist. So there you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Is the Oregon Timber Trail being developed or released in conjunction with other efforts in Washington and California around off-road trails? Because I know reading some of the history of the Timber Trail, Oregon was sort of maybe the pioneer with the Pacific Crest Trail, and then the other states kind of...
Yeah, exactly. So, other states have looked at it, and my colleague Gabe Amadeus has definitely been looking at opportunities across the border. It's just with one caveat that, you know, we continue to call it the Oregon Timber Trail in California and Oregon Timber Trail in Washington.
Right.
So, yeah, we're not going to let go of that one. But, there is definitely opportunity to expand this and hopefully maybe one day even connect it down to the Baja Divide. So, I mean... doing a whole Pacific Coast bike trail that's primarily single track is definitely an opportunity that is a worthy one.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the interesting thing too, I found, done some volunteer working for the Oregon Timber Trail, is many of these routes, as you said, are not very well traveled, but they're ancient. Mm-hmm. They're some of these paths that we're working on, or you're going to be riding if you take the Oregon Timber Trail, were created by the Native Americans or whoever the original people were to create paths for trading. So it's kind of, you're literally stepping on history and riding on history when you're going through these places.
Yeah, absolutely. There's many instances of that along the whole route. There's a segment along the Sanium Wagon Road that pioneers used, and that was also used for a great Western, a great transcontinental automobile race as well. So, I mean, there's so much history in the Oregon Timber Trail and along it. And when we release the route guide in a few weeks, there'll be a brief insight into all that amazing cultural and geological and environmental history in the area as well.
Nicholas Carmen, do you think that's something that you focus on when you're working on the routes that you're looking at as well?
Yeah, absolutely. The Baja Divide shares kind of a similar story. All the routing that we prescribed in the route guide and the GPS file is pre-existing, so I didn't touch the dirt ever with a shovel or any tools. Rather, we just found routes that were already on the ground, and most of the routes that we follow are vehicular width routes. I'd say some of them are probably ancient routes as part of the Camino Real when the Spanish were settling Baja California. But what we find in many cases are actually existing but kind of dilapidated or decrepit road-type routes. So these are roads that you wouldn't pass with anything but a highly capable motorcycle or maybe 4x4. So these do ride more like mountain bike trails, although you'll see double track along most of the Baja Divide. So yeah, we just use existing routes, and here we're providing information for people, and that's the real key. And that's the easy way to make a route, is that you just go do the research and then provide accurate and relevant information to people. And within a season, Lael and I were able to provide a 1,500-mile route to the public.
Well, and Lael right now is, and you're going to have to probably correct me, but is riding every road in Alaska? Is that correct?
Yeah, Lael is currently riding all the roads in Alaska. So it turns out there's not that many. I think in total it should number about 4,000 miles of riding. There's a few major paved roads, and there's a whole bunch of gravel roads that either connect places or just go out to a community, and then you have to come back. So she's doing that right now. But she and I have been touring together for about 9 years. So most of the riding we've done has been together, with the exception of some of the races she's done in the last few years.
Yeah, no, I was just curious. Does she plan on documenting this ride that she's doing?
Yeah. The current ride she's documenting. She's photographing right now. She's just sharing via social media. I think once she gets back, she'll be publishing on her blog, LaelWilcox.com, and then hoping eventually to maybe get a nice magazine article out to kind of focus more on what Alaska has to offer, because people have been coming here for years to go touring. They're either starting a long trip and leaving Alaska, or they come up and in many cases do like a guided tour with an organization. But there's a lot of places those people don't go because they're either staying to the beaten path or they're kind of planning their way out of the state. So they're focusing on leaving. And what she's doing is focusing on all the places that are less traveled.
Well, I think that's the beauty of the Oregon Timber Trail, the Baja Trail, or what Lael's doing right now is really highlighting these places that very few people go that are important to the fabric of the places that we live and the places that we adventure.
Yeah, and I guess without dusting off the old Schwinn out of my garage, what type of bike would you advise for somebody, an Oregonian, to take on the timber trail?
I'll let Kim tackle that one.
I rode a full suspension cross-country bike, and I actually just ordered a bikepacking bike. I've been inspired, and I'm riding the Baja Divide in January, actually. Nice. So I think this is all pretty neat how it's coming together. So I'll be taking out a bikepacking bike this summer to join a group on the Oregon Timber
Trail. And how is that
trail
different than the bike you were riding? Because some people use full suspension cross-country bikes for bikepacking.
Yeah,
so
my bikepacking bike will have a front fork. I'm actually going to have wider tires for the Baja because there's sand, so they'll be the 3-inch tires. And it will not have, on a full suspension, you have suspension in the back, whereas mm-hmm. a bikepacking bike will be hardtail in the back. And then it will have area to put in, packs and stuff to pack stuff. So when I did the Oregon Timber Trail, I carried a pack on my back that was probably 25 pounds.
Oh my God.
Yeah, the whole way, because I was nervous about what if there were enough unknowns that when Ben, my husband, and Leslie, who is a photographer who followed us, and she did storytelling and photography for us, they would meet us at checkpoints. So we were very methodical about it. And what I did is I packed enough that if I needed to spend 2 nights in the woods, I could. So I had enough food. I had a bivy. I had tons of water, everything that I needed on my back. So what's exciting about bikepacking that I'm learning is you put it on your bike. I don't even have to put it on my back. How crazy is that? This is great news. So I'm excited for the Baja because now hopefully I won't have to carry a pack on my back. So
yeah, I think that's one of the best parts. I still carry a pack for my hydration on my back when I bikepack, but that's just a preference thing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you to Nicholas Carman for joining us on the show today. If our listeners want to find out more about the work you're doing on new routes or follow your or Lael's adventures, where can they find you?
Well, if you want to learn more about the Baja Divide, then just visit bajadivide.com. Otherwise, I document our travels on my website, gypsybytrade.wordpress.com.
Great. And thanks also to Harry Delgard, Destination Development Specialist of Travel Oregon, and Kim McCormick, Oregon Timber Trail Pioneer. Harry, if our listeners want to find out more about the Oregon Timber Trail or check it out themselves, where can they find more information and where should they be keeping their eyes peeled for the big announcement of the route?
Yeah, so that's all going to occur on OregonTimberTrail.org. And stay tuned. The route guide should be released within the next few weeks, and it will be released directly on that route guide. Also, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, all the social media channels as well. So, yeah.
And really, we'd like to encourage any of our listeners who are out there and have been inspired to adventure today to go out and check out the Oregon Timber Trail or any of the other, or the Baja Trail. If you're thinking you're not quite ready for the Oregon Timber Trail right now, take 6 months out. You can do the Baja Trail in the middle of the winter.
Yeah.
It's there waiting. Please have a great summer and keep adventuring. You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcast from Portland, Oregon, on the first Wednesday of every month. Podcasts are on iTunes, and all past episodes are generously archived at thebikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The show is also produced by Alon Robb and Alex Zimmerman. We'd like to thank our in-studio engineer Tammy, without whom we'd be flailing through the airspace, our web host Chris Smith, and today's guests, as well as our editor Josh Hetrick. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the bike world. Until then, make it a great day and keep riding your bike.
It's time for the KBOO News at noon for Wednesday, July 5th, 2017. Yesterday, North Korea launched its longest-reaching weapon yet, an intercontinental ballistic missile, which landed in waters near Japan. Experts say the range shown covers the width of Alaska. In response, the Trump administration has called for, quote, global action. In local news, the city of Portland is planning to make available $350,000 in grant money to community groups who will act as a point of contact for victims of hate crimes. It will offer